Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Well, we're about to go through another Supreme Court confirmation process. Justice Anthony Kennedy has announced his retirement. Let's go to Professor Ronald Collins, who teaches law as the Harold Scheffelman Scholar of Law at the University of Washington Law School. First of all, for people who don't follow the justices closely and where they are ideologically, how would you characterize Justice Kennedy?
As an occasional centrist. In other words, the vast majority of cases, Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was nominated to the court by Ronald Reagan, has voted with the conservative bloc of the court. But of course, some of the very controversial hot button issues, reproductive rights, gay rights, he is with the liberals. On Second Amendment rights, he's voted with the conservative bloc. And he was also, at least in the context of First Amendment, was the author of the Citizens United case having to do with campaign financing and elections. So by and large, he is the last, if you will, limiting or break on the conservative bloc. In other words, if you take Anthony Kennedy out of the equation and you put in somebody to his right, then it's basically full speed ahead for the conservative bloc of the court, with the possible occasional limitation of its powers by the Chief Justice John Roberts. So in other words, this next confirmation may well be one of those pinpoints in time that determine the destiny of our nation. It is that significant, this appointment. And with this appointment, we are likely to see a new era of judicial activism, namely conservative activism. So this is a very important nomination. And if anything, it promises that our constitutional law will become more politicized than ever.
So in terms of who replaces him, what's the theory? Are they going to go for a full-on conservative, or would they try to replace him with somebody with a similar approach?
For my money, I think Judge Brett Kavanaugh on the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. He's in his mid-50s. He's very bright. He's very well regarded. And I think like Justice Gorsuch, Judge Kavanaugh or someone like him brings two things. The conservatism on issues important to conservatives, and I'll get to those in a moment, and some intellectual firepower. I think what is at stake here, first of all, the scope of executive power. This is going to be very, very important because President Trump has wielded executive power without a check from Congress in ways that we haven't seen really since FDR. So to what extent will the court curb executive power? Secondly, to what extent will it curb congressional power? It's likely to do so and rule in favor of more and more state autonomy. So taking, if you will, the power of Congress and giving it to the states. Of course, right now, that doesn't seem to make much of a difference because this Congress, Democrat and Republican, doesn't seem to do much. I think also very important to conservatives, the dismantling of the administrative state. That's going to be very significant. Next, the rise of religious conscience claims. I think we're going to see more and more of those in any variety of contexts. We've seen some of that this term in the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the case about the baker from Colorado who didn't want to design a cake for a gay couple. I think we're going to see the continuation and expansion of free speech rights, but in the service of conservative ends. The expansion of Citizens United, that precedent will probably be expanded, which will allow more and more money in federal and local campaigns. The demise of reproductive rights. I don't think there'll be five votes to overrule Roe versus Wade, but I think there will be five votes to dismantle it over time. Mm-hmm. The dismantling of affirmative action. I think the days of affirmative action will come to an end soon. More and more rulings in favor of big business. And finally, the end of the era of expanding gay rights. So I don't think you can have any more cases where the court expands gay rights. I think that's pretty much over. Those are all significant areas having to do with separation of powers, having to do with federalism, and having to do with individual rights. There's a lot at stake here.
I don't understand what it means to expand gay rights. As I understand it, mainly the request is just to have the same rights as everybody else, which is a conservative principle,
actually,
is it
not? It may or may not be a conservative principle. Remember, you know, these cases were 5-4. The last one, the gay marriage case of Obergefell, with a very strong and even powerfully worded dissent by Justice Scalia. And by the way, gay rights is not at the same level for purposes of constitutional scrutiny as discrimination against women or discrimination on the basis of race or discrimination on the basis of religion. So I would say that the court is probably not likely to take any more gay rights cases. There's a number of issues still to be resolved. Remember, for women's rights, it took about 20, 25 years of judicial decisions to kind of play that out. Mm-hmm. So I don't see that happening anymore. I also don't see any expansion of Second Amendment rights. The court has repeatedly, with the exception of Justice Thomas, refused to hear gun rights cases because the justices, at least the conservative bloc, is more inclined to support law and order causes. And if Second Amendment rights get in the way of that, you know, they had their one big case, and then after that, they refused to hear any more cases. Justice Thomas dissents from time to time, but I don't think that's going to change.
Professor Ronald Collins is the Harold Sheffelman Scholar of Law at the UW Law School. Professor Collins, thank you very much.
Be well.
Choke Points, brought to you by Online Trading Academy. Chris, of course, being the traffic coach, takes this all personally. He understands that every one of us is challenged by traffic, and so from time to time, he solicits questions, and then he goes about answering them. Are you ready for today's questions, Mr. Sullivan?
Yes, I am.
We're going to start with a question from listener Ricky, who drives on 167 daily. My condolences to you, Ricky. And he writes, Chris, can you tell me if the 167 on-ramp diamond lanes are open lanes during the morning commute? Are they like the toll lanes, which are open to public travel from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m.? He also wonders if solo drivers with good-to-go passes can use those lanes, because he does that a lot.
No, he doesn't. He sees
he sees
people doing that, and he's wondering if they're cheating the system a little bit.
I see.
At least from my understanding. And so the basic rule, and it's going to get confusing here, so you're going to have to stick with me, because there's some gray areas with the HOV system, but the basic rule you have to follow when it comes to HOV freeway ramps is that they are always active. They are always HOV required, unless there are signs to the contrary. So they always require 2+, even when the freeway HOV lanes are open to all overnight. So if you're on 405,
right,
and the lanes are open to everybody,
right,
you still, as a solo driver, cannot use the diamond HOV ramp.
Like the special little 405 ramp, I-5 ramp that goes to 405?
Yeah.
Down by the airport?
Yeah. I mean, you've got the, I mean,
it's got its own little special lane.
Right, where you normally have a ramp meter there, right, and then the other lane is HOV. No, those are always 2+.
Even after 7 p.m.?
Even after 7, unless
there's the sign that says that?
There isn't. The sign that says HOV is the only sign you need. What you need is a sign informing you that it's open to all. So if there's a sign, the diamond by definition means it's a diamond.
I see.
There needs to be a sign there that says it is not. So there are also some gray areas into this. On 167, where Ricky is, a lot of solo drivers with good-to-go passes who intend to pay their way into the hot lanes.
Mm-hmm.
They cannot use the HOV ramps either. This pass does not give you the magical ability to fly past all those other drivers if you're a solo driver. The same goes for 405. The toll lanes aren't on the ramps. The toll lanes are on the freeway. So if you have a good-to-go and you're solo and you're thinking of buying your way into a hot lane or the express toll lanes, you cannot use the HOV on-ramp legally.
Wait. What's the advantage, then, of paying $10?
Well, that's
to drive alone in the toll lanes. If you can't use the convenient ramp in the lane, you got to now cross over three lanes of traffic to get off, even though you paid the $10.
Yep, that's
who does that.
That's the way the law is written.
No, but who does anybody actually do that?
Does anybody actually stay in the lanes like they're supposed to?
Yeah, yeah.
From what I hear from my drivers, no. There are a lot of solo drivers who think that flex pass gives them the magical ability.
And why shouldn't they think that?
Well, because I don't, but again, there's nothing that says with this pass you can use that lane for the on-ramps. Now, there's even more confusion to this. The one place where this does apply for solo drivers are using the direct HOV ramps once you are in the express toll lanes. Like, for instance, there's one at 128 there in Totem Lake. You're in the express toll lane, and you can exit on your left,
right,
and go up there. You can do that as a solo with your good-to-go pass, but only when the express toll lanes are active. When they go off from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m., if you have a good-to-go pass and you're a solo, you still can't use that direct access ramp at 128. Those become those revert to HOV only.
Is there a community college course we could sign up for to understand this?
Well, I'm doing my best to explain it, and I know it's hard to understand, and it seems completely ridiculous. But those are the, and that's why Ricky asked me this question, is that, again, unless the sign says it is not HOV required, you must assume that it is. And if you're a solo with a good to go, that isn't a silver bullet. You have to wait in line like every other solo person.
Wow.
At least legally.
Okay. That flyover ramp from 405 southbound to the I-90 carpool lane?
Right.
That's okay.
That's a carpool lane.
That's strictly carpool all the time.
Well, because that's from freeway to freeway. So you've got to be in HOV all the time to be in that lane.
Okay. Let's get to the next question before we go too far on this one. Next
down
question.
The rabbit hole.
I know. Next question comes from Tommy, who drives a lot of suburban arterials. He wants to know how long you can drive. How long can you drive in one of those two-way left turn lanes? Because he sees a lot of people using that center lane to bypass others who are waiting for a light.
Yeah, so if you're not familiar, the two-way left turn lane is the ones that are marked by yellow, usually on the roads with one lane in each direction, or maybe even a couple lanes in either direction on some of the arterials. I'm going to set the standard for you. You know, say you're prepping to take a left at an oncoming intersection, but there's a line of cars in the general purpose lanes. You've got a left turn lane to your left, and all the way up, there's like one car at the light.
Right.
So you're going to jump in that left turn lane, fly past all those cars.
Well, not fly past.
Well, you know, just drive past them. And get up to the light. Well, you can't do that.
You cannot do that?
No.
You have to wait until you see the official left turn lane?
No. What you can do, under state law, you can only be in that left turn, double left turn lane, for 300 feet. That's the max you can be in there. So you're probably not going to get pulled over for that one.
That's like a football field.
Well, right. And if you think about it, that's about the size of about 20, 22 average size cars. Usually the backup's not that big, but you just got to keep that in mind. You can't just whiz by everybody. And the one thing you have to worry about is there's some people who wait to the last minute. You know, they wait through the line and then get over where you're supposed to.
Right.
I've done that several times because I'm a rule follower. Watch your back.
Yeah.
Because I've had some near misses where you get over thinking, well, why would there be anybody coming up behind me at 35 miles an hour? Watch out, because I've seen some, I've almost had some near misses with rear enders in that situation. But yeah, you get 300 feet in that lane. That's it.
Okay, next question. This is from Fritz and Kate. They want to know why there isn't a ramp meter from 160th to either 405 or 522 in Bothell, which is something you've talked about before.
Yeah, this is a kind of that new braided ramp that they've put in there. And in fact, this is the intersection where we've seen a lot of drivers bypassing the backups. They get off at 160th, go right over the top of 160th, and then get right back on the freeway. There was that cut-through traffic there. And in fact, the state put in signs saying that that was illegal. And cut-through traffic has actually gone down by about 50%. But the state research said that adding ramp meters there, at least in the afternoon, would help the flow of traffic. So they think that's something that might help. The problem is that's probably not going to happen because the state is in the process of rebuilding and redesigning the entire 522-405 interchange. Construction, though, isn't funded. So we're going to be stuck with that for a while. They're in the design phase of that. But they do think ramp meters there would work, though they're not sure that they have any money.
So there's going to be more work on that interchange?
Oh, that's all part of the four. As we build the official 405 express toll lane all the way to I-5, they're going to rebuild that entire bridge and that intersection with...
How many years is that going to take?
Probably about another 10. Once they get going.
Holy.
But it's good. It's real. I've seen the drawings of it.
Really,
it's
bad?
It's terrible. And that bridge is crumbling. Not crumbling, but it's not in the greatest repair. What they have planned there should really make an impact on that traffic. But again, that's a decade down the road.
Wow. But Tacoma's almost done, right?
No, Tacoma's almost done getting started. We've got about 3.5 or 4 more years, at least in I-5 downtown Tacoma, because they have to start on the southbound Puyallup River Bridge. That's going to start early next year, and that's about a 3.5-year project there, too.
Yikes. Don't forget to send your questions to Chris Sullivan. Don't always expect a coherent answer, because apparently with this whole... Diamond Lane thing, there isn't one, but send your questions anyway.
Yeah, I'll do my best. And if you have questions about that or clarifications, 98973, our text line, I answer them during the show. At Cairo Traffic on the Twitter feed, traffic@cairoradio.com, the email, I answer them all. I try to answer them during the show, too. But, yeah, this HOV one, there's a lot of confusion and a lot of assumptions. And there's some things that kind of, it would seem to make sense. If you're going to pay for that flex pass and be in that lane during the hours of operation, you should be able to use it. But according to the state, nope.
We need more digital signs. We've heard a lot from leaders in the city of Seattle about the need for a regional approach to homelessness. And now we're getting the King County plan, finally. KIRA's Hannah Scott sat down with the county executive to find out more. Hannah.
So, Dave, late last year, city and county leaders announced One Table, which brought those elected leaders together with business leaders, nonprofits, faith leaders, and community members to sit down all together, find ways to address homelessness regionally, including everything from short and long-term housing issues to addressing the root causes of homelessness. Now, city and county leaders are out with some of their first coordinated steps from that One Table program. It includes Mayor Durkin's recently improved plan for more shelter beds and tiny house villages. From King County, Executive Dow Constantine has plans for everything from investing in more affordable housing to new strategies to deal with root causes of homelessness like drug addiction and mental health crisis. For affordable housing, Constantine wants to bond against future hotel motel tax dollars to get an extra $100 million that would be used for affordable housing for people earning between 30 to 80% of the median income in the area.
This is a significant investment. It is still in the manner of a down payment because there are going to be greater needs than this and needs in various niches for housing, including for people who need on-site supports for the challenges they have in their lives.
Now, that on-site support he's talking about is proposing the expansion of a program the Ballmer Group has been helping the county with to build up capacity at nonprofit behavioral health centers in the region.
So that we are going to invest some of the rainy day fund from our mental illness and drug dependency tax to provide increased treatment on demand at clinics at these brick and mortar facilities, but also treatment on demand in the fields, whether it's in someone's home or at the shelter, that we're able to reach out to folks and help them begin to get on the road to recovery, even if they're not able to get themselves to a program.
That also means having enough capacity to help people as soon as they call for help, not saying, hey, we'll have room for you in 2-3 weeks, a month, when it may be too late. He also wants to increase the availability of medication-based treatment with Suboxone or buprenorphine, which helps people wean off opioids.
Medical professionals are limited in the number of people to whom they can prescribe buprenorphine. I think they've increased the number, but it is still far too little to meet the demand. So we want to try to fund additional positions. It doesn't have to be physicians. It could be nurses who have prescription authority, but to make sure that whoever needs it can get it.
That sounds nice. Do they have any goals? Does this finally mean we will see fewer tents?
So that was the first question I asked, because I know you always ask me that. I said, what does this mean? When are we going to see fewer tents on the street? I did not get a solid answer on that. Towards the end of our conversation, I said, it sounds like, you know, seeing a big difference here is going to be a couple of years as far as getting all of these type of programs into place. He seemed to kind of agree with that. What I can tell you is that affordable housing plan, the bonding he wants to do on the future hotel motel tax, is going to be a proposal that goes to the King County Council here in about 2 weeks. It's being drafted right now. A lot of these programs he's talking about are going to be requiring council approval. Mm-hmm. There's also talk, there's been a lot of criticism of One Table because not a lot has been accomplished in the first 6 months.
Yeah.
So governance is something that they're working on.
$100 million is what you said they're going to build. How many people does that house?
No numbers on that yet. I know there's $87 million that is already bonded prior to this request that's coming, and that is supposed to be, I want to say, about 1,700, as about 1,100 which are already done. The difference with this, though, is it would be specific for that 30 to 80% of that median income, with a primary focus, I believe you said, on 30 to 60% income. So it's a plan.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Tonight on Channel 7, you're going to find out how they clean up homeless camps, from how they select them to what they do about the residents. Nathan Wilson is the reporter on KIRO 7. So who did you sort of did a ride along with the navigation team?
Yeah, so they gave us quite a bit of access. We went along from beginning to end. We started in City Hall with the Customer Service Bureau, where they actually get the complaints. And that's a majority of their complaints now are about homeless encampments, even though they are kind of the catch-all for any kind of issue that people want to call the city about. From there, the complaint is put into a database that is then sent to the navigation team, and they look through that information that leads them to decide when they need to go out and inspect a camp. And so we went along through every step of the way at multiple camps, from the initial contact, another camp for where they did outreach, another camp, where they, and then two different camps where they did a cleanup and offered services.
Well, speaking of the decision-making process, what about a certain complaint would prompt them to act more than another complaint?
I think more often than not is the camper at risk because of where they are, or is the public at risk because of where they are, I think is a lot of it. And then also comes down to, are the reports of criminal activity, immediate jeopardy, a lot of drug use in that area, criminal activity, I think are kind of what takes them to a camp quicker than others. One thing that was interesting is that the number of complaints doesn't matter, because often they'll get call after call after call about a camp that they know is not a priority, but then there's one call about one camp that really concerns them, and that's the camp they're going to go to.
So in the camp that you watched them work on, was there evidence of drug use? Were there stolen items found, and what did they find there?
So in two of the camps, both were in the International District, both pretty close together near 10th and Weller, both had extensive drug use, especially the one in the Dearborn Corridor they had buckets of used needles. There were so many. Then the people who were doing the cleanup had to wear hazmat suits because the grass was so high, they weren't sure what they're going to step on. So it was clear that there was a lot of drug activity in the area. And we had even been through the camp before the cleanup and did see that there were, you know, evidence of people who were high at the time that we were walking through.
And are there latrines? I mean, what do they do about, you know, human waste?
They're very organized with how they deal with waste. It's not just lying out in the open. They will have a particular area. Sometimes they will use a particular tent as the latrine, and that's the tent that you obviously want to stay away from, because that's – and it's usually it's the tent that's further away from the camp, and that's how they kind of control the smell and the issue of human waste.
This doesn't sound like a job for the week, this navigation team. Who are these people going out there doing this work, wearing hazmat suits just to do a day's work?
I think that's one of the most impressive things about this whole process, was getting to know members of the navigation team. So if you think about reports of 400 homeless camps within the city, ranging from one tent to multiple tents, you know, that's a big job for that team. So they have the four field coordinators. They have about eight outreach workers that are contracted to the city through Reach. And then they also have a couple members of the Seattle Police Department that also work with them. It's incredible to watch them march into a homeless encampment, not knowing what's there, not knowing what they're going to encounter. But they are so dedicated to their job, they're willing to put themselves at risk, really, because they want to make sure the people in there are getting the care that they need, know that there are services to take advantage of.
And do those people take advantage of those services or not?
It's a struggle.
Why is it a struggle? If you're living with buckets of needles and you have a human waste tent and you're living outdoors, why would you hesitate to take them up on their offer of a dry, warm place to live?
I think there are a number of reasons that came up during our conversations. One is a lot of the beds are only at night. You know, there's the temporary shelters like the one at City Hall. Then people don't want to just go in there at night and then go back to their camp during the day. But there are also reasons. There are people who just don't want to be in a shelter. We did meet people who said, I just like being out in the streets. I don't want to go into a shelter no matter how many services you offer me. I just don't want
to. So they're defiant. Do they understand what an issue this has become and how people are getting less and less sensitive to them as this goes on? I mean, there are going to be some ugly scenes eventually because people are sick of this in the neighborhoods.
I did not get that sense from those who turned down services that they felt that there were repercussions for turning down the services. What I will say is that's a big part of the navigation team, is that they are encountering people over and over again, and it's their goal that, you know, by the fourth time that they encounter someone, they'll finally be able to talk them into taking the services. And that's the stat that they use, is that it usually takes about four contacts before someone will accept services. And the other statistics that came out of this is that about a third of people will accept shelter. And that's a number that's been fairly consistent through the navigation team's work.
Nathan Wilson, the piece is on the air tonight on Cairo 7. Nathan, thank you.
Thank you.
Our Sports Insider is brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is, James Osborne from the Brock and Salk Show. Mariners have beaten the Orioles 3 games in a row. There's one more today. And call it. Are they going to win?
Mariners sweep.
Mariners sweep, yes.
It would be the first time, I believe, ever that they've swept a 4-game series in Baltimore.
It will be, if it happens.
It will be.
Get out the dust?
Not until it happens, Colleen.
Really? Because you were saying that about the Yankees. You were saying it's going to be time to get... You were pre-setting.
Oh, I don't know what I'm talking about.
And look what happened.
But when they do sweep, then I will do that.
Because James has never heard it.
That's what I mean.
I'll come back tomorrow, just sit in the studio. I won't say anything. Just listen.
Exactly. So they're playing tonight, right?
Yes. They're playing this afternoon. They're playing, I think,
this afternoon.
Today.
Okay, yeah. So we'll know at noon. I can have time to rehearse. In the meantime, the survey is out of Major League Baseball players on, you know, how they think about various parts of the game, like speeding it up and things like that. And one of the things that did not score very well was the idea of a computerized strike zone. Something like 84% of players want to keep it the way it is with the arbitrary calls and the mistakes. Why? That surprises me.
Yeah, I think baseball players really appreciate some of the relationships that they get to have with the umpires.
Relationships?
Yes. And stick with me here. So pitchers, catchers, even batters typically have a relationship with every umpire. They call so many games in a year. And with that, they have an understanding of how a certain guy calls certain games. And they also have certain edges that they can do. Like a catcher can know, this guy's a little bit more inclined to call strikes low and away.
So that's the reason they can work the umpire in a way they can't work the computer.
Now, if you can't, here's some of the downsides of having a computerized strike zone where you know exactly which pitch is a strike and a ball every single time. Batters can now start to line themselves up in practice and say, if it is outside of this square box, no matter what, I'm never going to swing at it. So you're going to see an increase in walks. You'll see a decrease in strikeouts. You'll see a lot more hits and home runs, which is a lot of what baseball likes.
That's what I'm thinking, because isn't that the big dilemma for baseball right now? The games are just too boring because there's no hitting going on.
Yeah, that is a big part of it.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Part of the excitement, though, is looking at the ump, waiting for the hand signal, seeing what it is.
Get rid of my favorite thing in baseball, which is fights with umpires.
Yeah.
That is my very favorite thing in baseball, is when a guy loses his mind at an umpire. Like, there are very few sports where you can lose your mind at an umpire and you get a face-to-face shouting match. You get to be like an amateur like lip reader and see all the dirty things that managers are saying to umpires. I love that. Like,
and agree we'll or that. Disagree, these are highly skilled individuals. I know an MLB ump, a good friend of mine, is married to one. And as far as I know, he had to go through rigorous training, hours of minor league.
That's worse than the Supreme Court. He's got to be nominated, ratified.
Oh, yeah, and there's so few. I mean, how many MLB umps are there?
Oh, I can't imagine there's much more than 40 or 50.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean,
so
it's a good number of people. So yeah, but not. I mean, it's a very.
It's not as if these are just guys who like sports.
These
out
guys
there
have
calling.
To grind for years and years and years through the minor leagues, through amateur ball, through college.
So do you
baseball.
Think that there's any role for computers in sports? I mean, there's got to be a role for computers in everything, and why not sports?
Well, I'm kind of like Kip from Napoleon Dynamite, and I love technology. And technology has been making a lot of advances in sports. You have video replay, which is something that we couldn't even imagine 20 years ago in sports.
Right.
Which broke a big barrier there. In tennis, you have the automatic line calls,
right.
Whether it's in and out. So that's another computerized thing.
We got
the
superimposed scrimmage lines and the flying cameras.
Fans. Yeah, big things for fans. And I think technology, the biggest place it can help in sports is for fans to really understand and see the game clearer in a way that you probably can't see unless you played at a really high level.
So install them.
I was thinking wire up the players so we can monitor their vital signs in real time.
Oh, that'd be interesting.
It would be great. It's actually something that the players' unions won't allow. That's the biggest stopping ground in all of that, because they believe that teams could use that information to impact contract negotiations in the future.
So what aspect of baseball do you think would benefit from robots or technology like this? Sensors?
Yeah, I think... If there was some sort of a sensor maybe in the ball that could track different things, like the actual spin rate. I know that they have a
spin rate, yes.
Yeah, spin rate on baseball, so how fast the ball is spinning. They do a lot of that with StatCast.
What we need is a new statistic. Who can spin the ball fastest? Fastest spin rate.
That's right. What things we love about baseball. Let's just give more of what baseball is.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fine.
You look poised for a...
Well, I mean, having coached baseball for 12 years, there are a couple... I mean, I don't want to get rid of the umpire. Because I like the human element, and I also like James's point. I would think, after a little bit of walk, I mean, the batters would go up there looking to walk, and they would know where the zone is, and that would be no fun. I mean, no fun to see those great pitching, batting duels with an umpire in there looking at a slider outside. Is it there? Is it not? Did he make the swing on a two-strike pitch? I mean, there's a lot of that that I love to see.
Where's the soundtrack for The Natural when you need it?
Well, you know, I wouldn't mind having a little thing in the foul pole for you know, determining whether or not it actually is a home run or not. Yeah. If you extended that, you know, some sort of little laser that extended up to the, you know, as high as 500 feet, I don't know, so you would
Here's
know
what
was fair or foul.
I want a camera in the ball so we can see it approaching the panicked fan.
Yeah, that would be great.
Hey, umpires are wearing GoPros, in the College World Series. And so you're actually getting a view of the hitter making where the balls and strikes are. I love that. That's a really cool place I'd like to see.
Our Sports Insider is sponsored by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
Hannah Scott joins us. We told you earlier this week about Seattle firefighters who were doubling up on calls in parts of Pioneer Square and when they respond to homeless encampments because of safety concerns, which included what? Just to remind us.
So the safety concerns had to do with an incident last month where some firefighters who were helping a patient were surrounded and there was an assault involved.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So nobody's been fired at or anything.
No gunshots or anything like that yet.
All right. But the Firefighters Union says that was just the tip of the iceberg?
Yeah. So after this story we did earlier this week, the Seattle Firefighters Union president reached out to me and said, there's more to this. There's much more than this. Union President Kenny Stewart, who is also a lieutenant, he's a firefighter, he's a lieutenant in the fire department, heard that story, as I said, and he says this is a much bigger issue than an isolated incident leading to the doubling up of units in Pioneer Square.
What's important to us is the ability of firefighters to do our job, and we're seeing an uptick in violence against firefighters as we respond to the public and to the folks that are in those shelters. The violence that we've seen there is not just against firefighters. It's also directed towards the vulnerable folks in that population, as well as workers, citizens, and tourists.
And so you're talking about the homeless population on the streets and in those shelters in the areas around Pioneer Square and other hotspots in the city where you see lots of homeless encampments or homeless people on the streets. He says while there has been safety concerns around Pioneer Square for years, it's really escalated rapidly over the past few months.
We respond to shelters in Pioneer Square where services are provided, and the people either on the street or in the shelters are increasingly aggressive and actually assaulting firefighters in a way that we just haven't seen before.
And the reason for that would be they're trying to save somebody's life and they get assaulted for doing that? I don't get it.
It sounds to me like there's a variety of reasons, but there's almost a targeting going on where they just don't like the presence of any first responders, crew members, things of that nature. Being in that area. And this is, again, and I'll get to this in a moment, not everyone in this population. There's just a certain number of population that they're seeing this from, but it's escalating a lot, he says. So Stewart says that the kind of assaults they're seeing, by the way, include everything from verbal assaults, being aggressive and confrontational at them, as well as spitting on firefighters and actually grabbing them and hitting them. All of which not only hurts the firefighter's ability to care for a patient, but also puts firefighters in unnecessary danger. Now, he's quick to stress, again, this is not everyone in the homeless population or in these shelters.
There's just an alarming escalation of lawlessness, though, and it's becoming a more and more chaotic and hazardous environment. And it's related to the street population, the unsheltered people living in tents and RVs. It's not everyone, but it is alarming. And we do not want to wait until a firefighter gets seriously injured or worse to take action.
So what do Stewart and other firefighters think is behind this spike in aggressive behavior?
There's also a general lawlessness that's being allowed to flourish in the city that is having an impact. People are not being held accountable. You know, we work with a police department every day, and police officers are out on the streets, and we work together on incident scenes, and they appear to be just stretched thin.
And he says another big part of the problem is in that sense of lawlessness and chaos comes with the issues at the prosecutor's office and holding people accountable.
And there's also challenges related to the arrest and prosecution of violent criminals. When the police do arrest somebody, they're turned back out on the streets in 12 hours.
Stewart says firefighters should not be expected to provide a security force or even de-escalate situations when they get out on a call.
We need to focus on responding and providing emergency medical services and putting out fires.
So what's the answer here?
I don't have all the answers, but I think that, you know, we have, the city has to consider increasing the presence of law enforcement in Pioneer Square and other hotspots. I think the city definitely needs to continue sweeping unauthorized homeless encampments. You know, there are predators in that population amongst the, you know, regular people that are preying on that population and also, you know, creating an unsafe environment for firefighters, for tourists, for workers.
This is a theme we're hearing over and over again. And I think, I mean, a lot of us think there ought to be more cops. I read that we actually do have more police on the force than we ever have had in history. But when I check it against cities like Boston, for example, they have significantly more for a city roughly the same size. And I don't know. Nobody wants a tax increase. And of course, in Boston, they have an income tax. So if they want to, they can just tax the rich if they want to add to police. We right. can't do that. So has the mayor said anything about this?
So I want to point out that the fire department and the union have worked for months now. They've been talking with city council, with the mayor, prosecutors, city attorney, trying to kind of talk about that. He's trying to educate them on these dangers. He's not calling any one of them out specifically, but he's trying to stress that, look, we've been talking about this over several months, a year. This is going on now. It's getting worse during our discussions about it. We have to act right away, or sooner or later, something horrible is going to happen to one of these firefighters.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah. You bet.